before I go any further, I would like to introduce your 2011 Doug Wright Award nominees. David Collier. No, you have to come up now. I thought I made this clear. Tonight, as always, to assist in our trophy handing out. guys, that's not the right word at all. We appreciate her support and trust, and we're glad that she stuck through us through thick and thin. I'm grateful for her dignity in class that she brings to our event every year. So Miss Phyllis Wright is over here.
But particularly I was excited about the Canadian scene and, you know, Peep Show and Dirty Plant and Reed Fleming and things like that. And I always thought, I want to be part of that community somehow. And thanks to the Doug Wright Awards, I'm a part of the community without even doing anything. I don't have to exhibit any skill, like draw or anything. I'm just here. No one knows why. But I feel like I'm really in the heart of it. Here's an example, for instance. You know these Scott Pilgrim books by Brian Lee O'Malley? Great books. When I was on the jury, he gave him the award for best emerging talent, and then it went on to become a major motion picture. I'm not saying I had anything to do with that. But if you saw the film, I don't know, I did have a pretty good credit in it, which was director. Here, play the clip, if you don't mind. I'll show you what I mean. I think I'm joking.
Brad, he just followed me around. It's not his mouse. He's famous.
Hey, I'm talking to you, Scott Pilgrim.
He's famous when he talked to me.
The only thing keeping me and her apart is the 2 minutes it's gonna take to kick your ass.
Can I have your autograph, please?
So, how's life? He seems nice.
Did you hear that? That was my voice at the end saying, "And that's a cat." That was my voice. Thank you. Actually, they started the clip a little late and missed my cameo. Sorry about that. You guys started the clip a little. It's a short moment, but I am there. So I'm very proud of it. It was a big moment for me because I was in, you know, it's a Toronto story shot in Toronto. The last time that's ever going to happen, the film was a flop. But I'm not responsible for that. It was an important thing for me. And it's true I didn't get the part in Thor that I was hoping for, even though my audition was good and I think I really had the accent down. But it didn't matter to me because it's Canadian comics that I'm really excited about. And now, maybe it's since this film, I feel that whenever I read a Canadian comic, graphic novel, there's always one part that I think... There I am. You're on the far side, see? That's me. Different glasses. Whenever I see a Canadian comic book now, I always think there's one part that looks like it's made for my cameo. It's like they're thinking, oh, when this is a movie, that's Don McKellar's part. He's going to play that cameo. It's no other reason for the part. I'll show you what I mean. Maybe things just might heat up, but let's take a look at these clips from the best book nominees this year. Do it from the beginning this time. Bob, this is a moment for you to...
Moving Pictures by Catherine and Stuart Immonen. Set against the historical backdrop of the Second World War, French art curator Illa Gardner and German officer Rolf Hauptmann are forced to play out their private lives in a dangerous power struggle. Ila Gardner?
Yes.
Your passport was not among the papers you surrendered to the secretary. Perhaps you forgot to bring it with you.
Yes?
No, it's lost. I lost it about a year ago. I haven't needed it until now.
I think I can be fairly sure you are who I say you are.
Well, it's not like you to be uncertain, is it?
Ooh. It's kind of dark in here. Sorry, if I'm not interrupting, I just thought you might like some comic books. To pass the time, I'll leave them here. If you need anything else, I'll be outside. Okay, great interrogation.
What?
Bigfoot by Pascal Gerard. Small-town teenager Jimmy has a lousy best friend, a porn habit, and an uncle whose miserable existence is the embodiment of life stalled in its tracks.
Hello? Anybody home? Jimmy! I just saw something incredible! I got it all on video! I've got the details.
Stop shouting! Get out!
I got Bigfoot on video!
I'm dressing. Hang on a sec.
There! See him? And he disappears into the woods.
I don't know. It's hard to tell.
What do you mean? Sure, thanks. I came face to face with a monster. Do you have a pencil? I'll draw him.
I honestly think you should keep this whole story to yourself.
Chima, by David Collier. Chima is a winding autobiographical account of the author's decision to re-enlist in the Army at the age of 40 with the goal of serving in the Canadian Forces Artists Program in Afghanistan.
My tasking today, driving a bunch of young privates home from a weekend exercise. That's it, guys. Get all our kit in the back.
Present!
A bunch of young spirited privates. Still, I marvel at the way these kids today can make music and lay down rhythm tracks just by using their mouths. Which gives me an idea. Better jot it down. Just a few words, enough to help me out later. Lucky all that driving I did out in Saskatchewan taught me to steer with my knee for a couple of seconds anyway.
Through the miracle of modern technology, an image is transmitted from one speeding vehicle to another instantaneously.
It's Collier.
Can I see that, please? Corporal Collier, can I speak with you a moment? Just now, a photo was taken of you drawing while driving.
I wasn't drawing, honest.
In the military, punishment is swift, severe, and certain.
Corporal Collier, this is a serious allegation. However, I just heard you were nominated for a Doug Wright Award, so I'm letting you off the hook this time.
Yes, sir.
If you autograph my comic book. And under no circumstances fraternize with that Chester Brown from the United States soldier. Will not accept money from him.
The second issue of Lose takes a hard, dark turn into horror as two wayward children venture into the woods only to encounter monsters pulled straight from our worst nightmares.
You'd better stop sucking up to Mom and Dad, or I'm going to karate chop your balls. I've been practicing. There's a dude on YouTube who shows you how. Ha! I totally saw Jeffrey Stackhouse crying at the bus stop this morning. I effing hate Stackhouse. He's such a smelly little homo. He's that weirdo whose dad talks all retarded because of the war or something. Hey, what is that? Oh. A dude, gross. What are you doing?
Streakers by Nick Mandag. The story of three men, menial workers by day, who bond over an unlikely and thoroughly hilarious shared passion.
Wahoo!
The search for the perfect streak.
Hey, guys.
Hey. Well, I've got a juicy bit of news on the agenda tonight. Once again, through my connections in the international streaking community, I have secured us tickets to this year's Doug Wright Awards ceremony. We shall be flying to Toronto to attend one of the most prestigious events on Earth. In other words, one of the greatest streaking venues possible. My friends, this is to be my crowning achievement. During the speech for the Pigskin Peters Award, I shall expose my nude simian body to over 50 comic book aficionados.
Of course, it's always a great honor for you people to have me hosting this award. Blah, 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 blah.
Look at these clowns. I can't wait to hit them with a dose of medicine.
And the Pigskin Peters Award goes to...
All right, this is it. Here we go.
Oh, my God. I truly didn't expect this.
Okay. Here I go.
Hey, what do you have to ruin her moment for?
Well, if you guys want to streak, then I will. Congratulations to all the nominees. For Best Book Award.
Yeah, I want to thank Danny and everyone from Smiley Guy's studio for doing that clip. They look like me, right? I mean, pretty much. Except, actually, the one that doesn't look like me is that one in Streakers. There's some obvious problems, and Danny was having a hard time, and I went home and sat in front of the mirror and did some sketches to help him out. So it looks more like that, Danny, if you want to. next time, I'll just keep that. Speaking of Chester, though, because everyone is... You know, I was I wasn't thinking about this award show that much last week. We went, but I went to vote. We had an election here. I know some of these people are from America, don't we? Had an election here. I'm sure it didn't make the news down there. But I went to vote, and in my riding, Chester was running. He was a candidate for the Libertarian Party, and I forgot all about it. And I said, I really don't know the Libertarian platform, so I ran home, and I, you know, phoned up the Libertarian Party and said, is there a platform policy or some sort of election book or something? And so they gave me this. I got to say, it's a pretty persuasive case. This is one of the, particularly the economic policy is very, very strong. But then, for some reason, he didn't win anyway. And I don't know why, until I found out that Olivia Chow, who won, she's married to Jack Layton of the NDP. And it turns out Jack Layton also did a comic book, kind of in trying to compete with Chester. I took a look at it. It's quite good. It's true. A lot of it takes place, you know, in this shiatsu, and this shiatsu part of where he's paying for it. But it, of course, means a completely legitimate nude shiatsu massage in this case. But it's not just that. It also has some of his, about the rise of the NDP party and his early years as a member of parliament. I'll read a little section, one of the headings from one of the chapters, which is called Jack Off it says, a crazy party featuring one member that swells to form the official opposition. So that's, yeah, okay. Actually, it turns out Harper wrote some comics too. I don't know if you guys have seen these. You might have seen them. It's called Praying For It. You might have seen them in the subways. And yeah, it's not really very good, I read. It's more like an attack ad than a comic, really, to speak of. All right, I don't know. That's the end. I had a funny Ignatieff Chris Ware joke, but no one could draw it. So we're going to move on. I know some Americans here, and they don't know what I'm talking about. They're still into that, still excited about that last collector's edition of The Amazing Obama, where he got his arch enemy and the anti-Obama and killed him, which is a little too good to be true, by the way. And some alternate universe stuff happening there. Okay, Greg, play us into the first award.
Sure.
Yeah, here we go. This is the award for the Pigskin Peters Award, which recognized the best in experimental avant-garde or non-narrative cartooning in Canada. And the nominees are Indoor Voice, by Gillian Tomacki, published by Drawn and Quarterly. Yeah. Indoor Voice is a compelling peek inside the creative process of one of Canada's most exciting talents, ranging from short, ironic comics about Brooklyn street life and personal political growth to studies of mutating animals and human sexuality. Takami's impressive range gets center stage here as each page is filled with her explorations in pen, brush, ink, watercolor, and collage experiments. Gillian Tomacki won the Wright Award for Best Book in 2009 for her graphic novel, Skim. Yes. Right there. Center stage. The next one is Stooge Pile by Seth Scriver. Is this correct? They gave me the phonetic pronunciation, but it seems wrong to me. Scriver, no? Yeah, Scriver, right? Published by Drawn and Quarterly. Flipping through Stooge Pile is like going to a fancy art opening, only to find that once you've arrived, the place is packed with drunk, fat posers. The art draws from wonderfully diverse set of influences, from Saturday morning cartoons and outlawed biker designs to Terry Gilliam and Art Crumb. A visually exciting mix that treads a thin line between candy-coated sweetness and pure vulgarity. Stooge Pile, that was it. Okay. So I've Been Told, by Marianne Hardy, published by Conundrum Press. Marianne Hardy's so I've been told, pushes at the edges of traditional narrative in seductive and unexpected ways. Hardy's work mines a rich vein of folklore and personal mythology via a half-dozen exquisite illustrated tales of dreams, night rambles, Jerry Springer guests, and call girls who inherit stuffed balloons. Shifting through ink drawings, screen printing, paintings, and embroidery, Hardy's first published work challenges preconceived notions of what a comic can be. Yes, the next one is Spotted Deer. Michael George, published by Koyama Press. Like a lost episode of the Audubon Wildlife Theater's broadcast from the Twilight Zone, Michael DeForge's Spotted Deer is an otherworldly travelogue on the habits, habitat, and culture of a species of large Canadian slugs, which physically resemble deer. Typical of DeForge's distinctive and rapidly growing body of work, Spotted Deer deftly combines the beautiful with the repellent. It is a work of true originality. DeForge won the Best Emerging Talent Award in 2010. Wowie Song, number 3, edited by Patrick Kyle. Jeanette Lepon and Chris Kuzma. See, the phonetic spellings don't help me at all. They actually make it harder. Published by Koyama Press. The editors of Wowie Song, a Toronto-based anthology of cutting-edge contemporary Canadian comics, assemble their handsome booklets with the taste of a collector and the eyes of a curator. Chris Kuzma, Jeanette Lepon, and Patrick Kyle mark their anthology with their own cute brute aesthetic, but they also grant their contributors free rein. Here we find graphics that are either exquisite or challenging, but always bold and playful. Each page of Wowie Zog, number 3, allows imagery to collide with storytelling in an explosion of new, exciting ways. And now, the winner. What? Oh. Now, taking the stage, Seth. Here we are. Okay. I'm going to open the envelope. And the winner is... Loose, number 2, by Michael DeForge. Includes a hat, and actually I think this year comes with a whole wardrobe that Seth has designed out of cardboard that the winner can wear, a small little village to live in, so.
Thank you very much. This is a real honor, and all of my comics I really owe to Anne Koyama, my publisher. She took a real chance on me. A few years ago, and I've been very grateful to her, and she's supported a lot of other artists who I really love and admire. Also, thank you to Laura Legg, my girlfriend, for being very supportive of me also, and friends like Ryan Sands and Chris Eliopoulos. Thank you very much.
Now, the next award. What's going on? Oh, yeah, how are you doing over there, Bob? Did you get it?
Oh, yeah, good. The paper's sticky on the back, so every time I flip it over, it gets.
Oh, okay.
But I got a whole bunch of them. Want to see them?
Okay. What are we doing?
The pre-show. Just trying to draw as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
These are all the nominees.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah.
Lots of you.
Yeah, that's why you're there. Okay.
The nominees for that book. And where we are now.
Okay. Okay, Bob. Thank you very much. I'm going to give you a really, really good model to draw now, because, you know, when we were thinking about this show, we thought maybe we should have a male and female co-host this year and, you know, get someone to tracked if we could sing a song or something. And then we watched the Oscars and we thought, no, that's not a good idea. So instead, we're just going to have her present. The first person we thought, we're very excited to get Erin Karplik from CBC's Television's Being Erica to present the Doug Wright Award for Best Emerging Talent. Erin!
And picking up a pack of Hubba Bubba and the latest edition of Archie Comics. I would sit in my playhouse and read it cover to cover. Oh, the angst and the sexual subtext. In fact, you know, looking back, I'm not sure Archie was all that child appropriate. Aren't they just a really incestuous group of horny teenagers? And I'm pretty sure Archie was the direct inspiration behind Big Brother. I mean, Betty and Veronica are essentially the two biggest floozies on the planet. And everybody is always blaming Veronica, but Betty, come on, get some self-respect. You're obviously the town's sloppy seconds. I would like to see Betty, Veronica, and Archie on an episode of Maury Povich, where Maury would say, Betty, your boyfriend Archie has been sleeping with your best friend Veronica for the last 70 years. And then the audience would be, boo, and he'd say, wait, there's more. Reggie's been hanging out with her, too. The results are in, and Betty, you have chlamydia. And she would probably be like, oh, thank you, Archie, so much for choosing me as your STD recipient. So congratulations, Betty. You pretty much represent a giant leap backwards for womankind. And between us, what about Jughead? I mean, why didn't he ever get any action? I'm from Alberta. I love cheeseburgers. I love sleeping. I mean, I'm just waiting for my own personal Jughead. But in the meantime, Archie, he has been around the block for the last 70 years, so I think that it's time to celebrate new comic talent, and I'm pleased to announce this year's nominees for Emerging Comic Artists, and the nominees are Erin Costain, for Entropy number 5. Entropy is an ongoing road trip that freely blends creation myths from various cultures. The latest issue features two naked men, one black, one white, literally, who awaken as prisoners in a horse-drawn wagon driven by a pontificating cat. Cartoonist and architect Erin Costain's line work is stark, yet warm, and his heart-telling story manages to ground what could be a flight of fancy in a natural-seeming universe. Next up, should we do a round of applause for him? Next up is Alex Fellows for Spain and Morocco. In his online comic, Spain and Morocco, Montreal's Alex Fellows tells the story of Walt and Dan, two slacker roommates who abandoned their going-nowhere lives to travel to North Africa and Europe. Distinguished by Fellows' observant art and lush colors, Spain and Morocco captures the highs and lows of youthful roaming, ranging from the grunginess of hostels to the enticement of a faraway fling, and delivers it all with a keen eye for dialogue and a judicious use of humor. Fellows was also previously nominated for Best Emerging Talent Award in 2005 for his book Canvas. Next up, we have Keith Jones for Catland Empire, published by Drawn and Quarterly. In Catland Empire, Toronto artist Keith Jones makes a plea for us humans to learn something from the feline race. His smartly dressed cats love nothing better than eating hot dogs, rolling in catnip, and chilling with their fellow felines. Humanity, on the other hand, is set on a course for violent self-destruction. With his vibrant colors and hilarious timing, Jones takes a childlike glee in showing us how fun and uninhibited life would be if we could only merge our universe with that of Catland. Jones was also previously nominated for Best Emerging Talent Award in 2007 for his book, Bacter Area. Next up, James Stokoe for Orc's Tane, Volume 1, published by Image. With furious cartooning chops and a baffling amount of imagination, James Stokoe creates the universe of Orcstane, a world that manages to celebrate and subvert the fantasy genre at the same time. Seen through the eyes of his anti-hero, One Eye, or I guess that would be One Eye, seen through the eye of his anti-hero, One Eye, Orcstane winds through the nonstop action scene after another as the reader waits in suspense. Not just to see whether One Eye will survive in his unpredictable world, but also what baroque, demented, fever-dreaming Stokoe will scrawl on the next page. Next up. Next up, Tin Can Forest, aka Marek Kolek and Pat Shuchuk for Baba Yaga and the Wolf, published by Koyama Press. Baba Yaga and the Wolf is a picture-driven story about magic and religion, nature and the supernatural, love and hate, featuring a cast that includes witches, werewolves, the devil, murderers, evil husbands, and loving sacrificial wives. Playing out like a cross between Little Nemo and Slumberland, Pier Paolo Pasolini, and Eastern European animation, this book is dreamlike in its movement, lush as a Russian banquet in design, and poetic as a fairy tale. And the winner for Best Emerging Talent is Phyllis and Seth. And the winner is Alex Fellows for Spain and Morocco.
Montreal's Alex Fellows with this year's Doug Wright Award for Best Emerging Talent. In Spain and Morocco, a humorous yet affecting graphic novel currently being serialized online, Fellow lives up to the lofty promise shown in previous works such as Blank Slate and Canvas, which earned Fellows a nomination for the same award in 2005. Spain and Morocco tells the story of a restless young man named Walt and his sad sack roommate Dan, friends who, almost on a whim, embark on a two-week pilgrimage to Europe. Almost as soon as they step off the plane, Walt and Dan encounter two sisters who threaten to derail their grand tour. Fellows' illustrations not only perfectly capture the languid Spanish afternoons, sun-soaked beaches, and cramped hostels, which any backpacker will recognize, but also the fleeting nature of a one-night stand and the rude awakening of the hangover the following morning. Spain-Morocco is a beautifully crafted story about love, friendship, and most of all, life. With an artist's eye and a poet's tongue, Fellows chronicles the strange journey of two lost men without ever losing the reader's attention. We cannot wait to see where Fellows takes Walt and Dan next. He is unquestionably deserving of this year's Doug Wright Award for Best Emerging Talent.
So I don't get a hat? Or thanks a lot to Brad for supporting my work and always pushing it ever since absolutely no one knew about it, and the nominating committee and the jury for picking it and that nice introduction, and to my wife for watching it in slow motion line by line, patiently letting me do it from 10 at night till midnight. when I have a little bit of energy left. And I really didn't think of anything to say as a horrible. I'm sorry. We went for dinner just before, and she asked me, like, did you think of anything to say in case you win? And I said, yeah, but I didn't. And I'm just like, one word is coming out after the other. So yeah, thanks everyone.
Jackets that Seth and Brad, but you're gonna have a good chance to see them because I'm going to introduce to you now. Are we ready there? Okay, two of Canada's finest cartoonists. One of them who has just been on stage wearing a beautiful jacket, and that is Seth. He was a presenter, but he's also a cartoonist, as it turns out. Guelph-based cartoonist behind the long-running comic series Palookaville, graphic novels Clyde, Tans, Wimbledon Green, and George Sprott, which won him last year's Doug Gray Award for Best Book. Masterful cartoonist, in-demand illustrator, designer. His works were the subject of a one-man show right here in this art gallery. And he's going to be talking to David Bowell, Vancouver cartoonist who's responsible. I'm reading this. I actually literally read this piece of paper that they gave me. I have it here for proof that that was not a mistake. David Boswell. Vancouver cartoonist who's responsible for the seminal alt comics Heartbreaks. What? Heartbreaks comic Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman. Part bully, part crusader for the working stiff, Fleming quickly outgrew his underground status to become a pop culture sensation. It remains a defining moment for countless comic book fans who came of age in the 80s. That includes me. And Seth and David are both fans of their own work. Each other's work even more so. They just met, and now they're meeting for the first time on stage. Please welcome Seth and David Boswell.
Sometimes things pay back. I've got a son
who made a New Year's resolution this year to wear a tie every day, no matter what. I don't know why, but there's some kind of strange circularity there. I was never that much of an artist when I was young. I did sketch and draw a bit, and I was encouraged by people who made me think that there was some potential for advancement in the profession. And when I decided to become a cartoonist, I was at that time working in a darkroom here in Toronto as a darkroom technician, not to be confused with Gigolo. Works every time. And anyway, working in the dark was not bad in the winter, but as the weather got nicer in the spring of 1977, I thought there's got to be a way out of here, because I hated leaving the dark room and the sun was going down already. I missed the whole day. So luckily, a friend named Cynthia McCarthy encouraged me to send my drawings out. She would take my drawings to where she worked, and people would give good feedback. So the turning point was hearing that the New Yorker paid $600 for one single panel cartoon. My rent then being $45 a week, I thought, a couple cartoons a year, I'm laughing.
Yeah.
However, I found out quickly, nobody buys first time from anybody. They want to see you can, you know, deliver the goods repeatedly. Sure. So I was sending a package to the cartoon week after week to the big magazines, Esquire, Playboy, New Yorker, National Lampoon, and I still have a fine stack of rejection slips. But luckily, I was told to send work to the Georgia Strait, a Vancouver underground paper. It's not underground anymore, but they bought not one of my single panel cartoons, but a full page strip I had done called Heartbreak Comics, which featured a guy named Laszlo, great Slavic lover. Now, he's not really a Slavic, he's Hungarian, but still.
Yeah.
Now, it only happened because the guy who responded was himself of Slavic descent. And he had some addiction problems, but he liked my work. He told me he wanted more. He didn't tell me that he had no authority to order more comics. He was only the advertising manager. The publisher knew nothing about this. But I thought, hey, I've got a weekly gig here, and decided to do more. However, $20 a week instead of $600 for a single panel, it was tough to keep a, you know, keep house and home together.
So did you think you might be a gag cartoonist then? Like, that you might just do single panels at that point?
Single panels are very, very tough.
They are.
I've done a few. There might be some on display here. Eventually, this is kind of a mixed bag of pictures, but that's very hard. It's got to be like a knockout punch. It's got to work immediately.
Yeah, it's a tough field. I mean, I wouldn't even want to consider it, but I have no sense of humor, so. But it's like, I guess the thing is, were you sending out single panel gags at first, or were you sending out a bit of both?
Well, mostly single panels.
Okay.
And eventually, after I started publishing, I was able to foist these unused single panels on the Georgia Strait.
Okay,
one by one, they did get repeated.
If the New Yorker had bit, do you think he would have just worked in single panels from then on, or would you have had a hunger to do bigger stories?
I really can't say that. I just don't know how that would have played out. The New Yorker style of humor would not probably have been mine. It's mostly
it's hard for me to picture
it
in a way, you know, especially with the kind of stuff you were doing at that point, too.
Yeah, there's some early work there. That's not New Yorker material at all. It's not as...
Like, your work, like Reed Fleming particularly, I mean, Heartbreak for Comics was first then.
That's right, yeah.
And then Reed came along. So did you redraw Heartbreak Comics then when you did the book collection of it?
Well, I had to.
Because it's quite different from the Reed material that came before that edition.
Well, the style of the comic should match the character's personality.
Yeah.
So Reed Fleming initially was drawn on sketchbook paper, really kind of rough. And I had sort of a rule, one pen, one panel size, kind of like John Candy's character, Johnny Lero in Street Beef, right? Just real minimal. And, of course, Heartbreak is much more elaborate. The character was inspired in part by the Latin lover, the continental lover you'd see in old Hollywood movies. So I thought the look should emulate sort of a 30s type of movie, using tonality as an element, not just lines. So that's a lot more work. You know,
it's
just hatching. You start with white and work down to dark gray, and it takes a long time. The second book, the book of that, was 3.5 years in production, and the art is 15 by 20.
Wow.
I did it twice as big as it's printed, so when you shoot it down, it looks really tight and sharp, you know.
Okay, well, then here's a question about that. You produced Reed, like, obviously in a much rougher style, and then when you did Heartbreak, you know, that was like an incredible incredible amount of work. Like, your ambition obviously really grew between the two works. Like, what were you thinking? Like, did you see this as, like, you're going to be your magnum opus? Was this, like, something that you saw as, like, a real great work you were working on?
Well, I hate to say I was thinking ahead like that, but I did feel I had one chance to do that book, and one chance only. In fact, my first child was born during the production of this book. And I don't think I can take that amount of time today to do a book.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You've got to have dough coming in. So I knew I had one shot at it, and I thought, I've got to get this right. Some of the material that was inspired by, you know, real-life experiences, but, you know, highly disguised and covered up.
Well,
but I had stuff that I just had to express, and I wanted to get that out and sort of lay the ghost, so to speak, you know, get that out of my life.
Well, it's funny, speaking of expressing stuff, I mean, Reed Fleming himself. Reed Fleming is a complicated character. Oh, okay. He's kind of a complicated character because, I mean, in Reed Fleming, the first book, he's kind of like a lovable asshole, sort of.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Which is heartbreaking. He's a lot darker. He's actually kind of frightening.
Well, originally he wasn't going to be in that story.
Yeah.
But I needed to have another man, like somebody
yeah.
to function as that. And I thought, why not use Reed?
Yeah.
And so he had to sort of fit into that part. I've had people say, yeah, he's too violent.
He's pretty scary.
And
in that,
but
he frightens me.
But he should be, I think, because there's got to be a consequence to that kind of
behavior. He loses his lovableness in there, for sure. It's like, it's funny because when you return, like in Road to Riches, he's lovable again, but that sort of is a prequel again.
Lovable?
It goes back. Yeah, he is
kind of.
Well, I mean, it's a stretch, but he's kind of lovable.
Well, what he does with tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
And
kind of
really
on his side, even though he's a horrible person.
Yeah. What it is really, I hate to be too thinky, but it's sort of a satire on the idea of machismo.
Okay.
So Reed Fleming plays that part for his own private amusement. And
do you like Reed?
Well, yes and no. There are times when I have to get right away from the character. You know, like, it's very intensive to write and draw a book, and when I'm done, I want to be right away from him for a long time. It's tough to be around him.
Does he reject any part of your own personality?
I hope not. Well, I'm good at delivering if I have to deliver, but I never delivered milk, I delivered pizzas.
Oh, did you?
Yes, that's what I did after college.
Okay. Yeah.
But
I worked in a jewelry factory after college.
But in retrospect, it turned out to be a very beneficial thing. Like, I couldn't have done that comic if I hadn't actually had the experience of going door to door and interacting with people. And the other thing was, too, that I saved all my tips. And with those tips, I bought a drafting table, which I still have. And if you're going to be a cartoonist, you have to have a good place to work.
Yeah.
So I still have that, and that's the real legacy of my career as a pizza driver.
Now, you know, Reed isn't a very Canadian character. I mean, he's pretty aggressive. Were you reacting in any way against your kind of upbringing in, like, you know, Ontario, like Protestant, boring Ontario?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, stir things up a little bit.
Yeah. Actually, this kind of connects to that, like, obviously in some way you come out of the underground comics. Like, did you read the underground
comics? No, I didn't. I was never a comics person, and I'm still not good at comics person. My influences were all old movies, silent movies, and music.
Yeah.
And until I came to Vancouver, I didn't know much about undergrounds at all. When I came up to do the strip in 1977, luckily the Straight was also a distribution company for old comics.
Yeah.
I had no place to live, no money, so I'd stay in my office all day long, and at night I'd let myself through a crack in the wall into the warehouse where they had all the old comics. And so I kind of caught up when someone was just reading it every night. There's some good ones and some bad ones, but I got a bit of education that way. Yeah, this is a commission piece here. Help the fight against illiteracy. Visit your local swimming pool.
Obviously, you had strong influence in the absurd, too. But I mean, in general, so much of the work, especially like, well, in all the work you've done, there's a real strong sense of the absurd. Like, is that a basic element of your character, or is that something that you set out, like, the specific influence that you wanted to express that?
Well, I would guess that it's inherent. You can't desire to be something like that. It's just part of the way I think I see things. And that, in turn, is influenced by those with whom you grow up.
Yeah.
Even my parents. Like, my dad had a pretty good sense of humor.
you know, a little bit of a curveball at times, and I was always encouraged by my parents, you know, to pursue these things. When I decided to get into the field of arts, you know, I was never told, well, how are you going to do this? It was, you know, they bit their tongue and paid the bills.
Good, yeah. I mean, my parents were like that as well. I sometimes think that with my parents, it was because we came from kind of a lower economic background where they didn't recognize what a bad choice it was. They thought that going to the arts was a step up.
Here's a Valentine's Day drawing. That screen supervisor there, and Cupid has shot the arrow into the wrong ass, and Reed's reacting accordingly.
Now, to go back to what you mentioned about early film, for example, yeah. It's clear, like, especially reading like Heartbreak Comics, especially, you can see early film in it. Yeah, I think just about anybody reading that would recognize that, you know, that early 20th century, the kind of melodramas, maybe European film, silent film, of course, it's really strong. There's a slapstick quality, of course, but there's something darker too, you know, the German expressionism. Where did you get that interest from? Like, how did you get exposed to that work? Like, why would, I mean, you were pretty young when you did that work, so you already had that under your belt.
I'm still young.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's what you see, visual arts really grabbed me from the get-go. I can recall the first time I saw the work of Gustave Doré. I was 11 years old, but it just somehow rang a bell, and I thought, God.
And where did you come across that?
The Old Farmer's Almanac.
Oh, okay.
They would rip off art and use it for illustrations, but still I see it and think, that's amazing work, and how is that done? And it's all tiny little lines. And you find out that it was done in boxwood, it's engraved.
Yeah.
So it's like white on black, done in reverse, so to speak. And it didn't look like anything I was seeing then. So I became aware of tonality as an element of, you know, visual art. And the same thing with movies. You know, old movies look different from new movies. They look more like another world, whereas
for sure.
New movies often look like they're just, you know, guys in front of big lights with costumes on.
Did you see this stuff on TV, or did you like manage to get laboratory cinemas? Or?
Well, in the 50s, when I was growing up, they had a lot of this stuff. Obviously, TV was, you know, voracious in terms of what it needed to fill. So everything was shown, old cartoons and Flash Gordon serials and old movies. And I responded to comedians, especially Laurel and Hardy, Buster Keaton. And when I discovered W.C. Fields and the Marx Brothers when I was 14, those were red-letter days in my life. I just was an instant huge fan. And to this day, I think Fields is probably the greatest, one of the two greatest film comedians of all time.
I think I'm more a Laurel and Hardy fan.
Well, they're big, too.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think I had the same kind of experience to some degree with television. I mean, it was 10 years later, probably, for me, in the late 60s and early 70s. Like, so much of what television was in those days was kind of like a backwater of the old pop culture.
Yeah.
You know, you'd turn on, they were using this stuff for filler. But, you know, you'd catch all, like, the early Universal films or the Laurel and Hardy's or whatever. And as a kid, you didn't realize, like, you know, I mean, like, this stuff struck a chord with you, but you didn't realize, like, just how potent this material was. This was just filler on television. But later you realize, you know, like, this was some of the great works of the pop culture of the 20th century. And it's like it just came through to you in, like, the junkiest kind of medium. And the same with comics. I mean, another perfect junk medium that, you know, has ended up producing, like, a lot of interesting work, like, when you look back on it.
Well, the first Reed Funding page, and Reed Funding was supposed to be a one-off. There was no intention of doing a series. That first page, I don't think I have it here, but if you've seen the book, it starts off, the first panel, Reed Funding is beating the crap out of the guy. And the second panel, you find out why. It's because the guy Reed Funding his milk truck. So overreaction to trivial provocation. But he goes through this first page doing one awful thing after another, and it culminates in him, you know, pouring milk in a customer's aquarium, and then she reacts, he grabs her and says, 78 cents or I piss on your flowers. The point is, it stopped there. Now, that, those kind of films and the culture in which you're talking about, there was always a pay of bad for bad behavior. Bad guys got punished. You can get away with that shit. And in this case, before he gets any kind of retribution, it stops, right? So it's a denial of expectation. And here it is here. It's really looking very bad in this blow-up, but you can see he's just doing all the things you should not do, especially when you're at work. And the problem was that I'd done this first page, and I thought, this is the entire character. There's nothing more here.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to do more refinings. It was just a one-off. And I got a lot of response from George Strait readers, and You know, finally I decided after one particularly charming letter, actually some guys at the shipping department, Woodward's department store, had drawn a comic strip where Reed Fleming burst into the Georgia Strait offices, threw Laszlo, great Slavic lover, out the window, and then threatened me with severe harm if I didn't do more strips featuring him. So I thought, man, I can't just let this go, so how can I do a second page? So then I had the problem of making the character live. You got to create an entire world.
Yeah, for sure.
You got to think, who else lives there? How does, you know, it work? How's he able to stay out of jail? You know, like in real life, he'd be in a can in no time. But he's got this setup here where he's got a boss. The overall boss is kind of a meek gentleman. And his manager, who's, you know, secondary in rank, is a bastard, but he's not the top guy. So he plays them against one another and manages to walk that line between unemployment and imprisonment.
Well, that's true. It's the great thing, actually, in Reed Fleming is how you did create like a very fully realized world, but it's a very strange world. I mean, even the way that you drew that world, like the interior of like the milk company with the train that goes through it and that bizarre
into the basement
track that goes down. It's like there's something like really solid and believable in the reality you created, even though it's like a completely improbable kind of world. I mean, Reed's behavior, of course, the boss's behavior, all of it. But there's somehow it's like you made such a firm grounding of it that you buy right into it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way you drew it too. Your style is kind of unusual in that it's not cartoony and it's not illustrative. It's a mix of the two, which is kind of unusual in comics. I mean, you got people with pointy noses and square heads, but they're fully realized with a ton of hatching. Like, was there something that, like, you were thinking of when you started that style, or did it just grow naturally out of, like, were there other cartoonists that influenced your work in that way?
I wouldn't say so, but I couldn't draw any other way, and sometimes I look at my own work and I think it really doesn't stand up to inspection, because there's so many inherent self-contradictions. Like, you know, to me, the essence of cartooning is the clear line, like Winsor McCay.
Sure.
If you do it all in one line, that's as good as it gets. So in a way, you shouldn't have to use all this stuff, but I thought, most comics don't use, you know, like Doré's sense of light and shade.
Yeah.
You know, why not use that? And it's incongruous enough, I think, to work fairly well.
It does.
This is the cover of number two. And like all those buildings there, some are real, some are imaginary, but they're all drawn for real. Like, I never trace photographs or anything like that. When I was doing Heartbreak Comics, which is in a very realistic style, I had to stop after a year and a half and learn how to draw architectural perspective because I wanted a certain shot. And you can't fake a spiral staircase, right?
Yeah, that's pretty
so bad. I had to stop, and that took a while to figure out.
I'm still faking it.
But like this here, with perspective, you can control the space in every particular, front to back, and I often use like 6, 7, 8 planes of action to create depth. And that's, you know, one element of the book that isn't interesting, but I try to put enough into it so that when you read it a second or a third time, there are discoveries to be made. Not just in the look, but in the writing, there's all kinds of like subtext, like this music with counterpoint going on. Other stuff's happening.
What kind of music do you like?
Well, quite a range. I wouldn't say anything exclusively, but I like a lot of so-called classical music.
Yeah.
But I like a lot of early American popular music from the 1890s to about 1935 or so.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
But I listen to a lot of avant-garde stuff sometimes.
Come on, people.
Oh, right.
There we go.
And if it was a real Reed Fleming, right?
person with the name attached. He was like the bad boy in my kindergarten class. And I understand that he's gone to some kind of rehabilitation and greater glory, perhaps, as an Anglican minister. And luckily for me, he's not of a litigious nature, has never sought to sue me for appropriating his name. There's other refundings, of course. But the name seemed to fit the character. But, you know, the drawing came first. I should say, when I decided to become a cartoonist, spring of 77, I had got back my income tax return, $612.95. So I thought, I'll quit my job in the darkroom and give myself 6 months to make as a cartoonist. And as it happens, exactly 6 months from the day I first drew the heartbreak page, I was in Vancouver working. But that was just coincidence. It wasn't like I had some master plan. So it just worked out that way.
I was actually wondering, why did you go there? Just because you
probably... Because of the street, yeah. They said I'd get paid more readily if I was there instead of in Toronto, because they paid once a month. $20 a week, yeah. Once a month. And I starved. And, you know, I think it's
good to start there. The money goes to somebody else.
Exactly. Well, the street in those days was, this is not a trade secret, they were also publishing sort of a semi-porn rag called the Vancouver Star. And often you got paid off in the $1 and $2 bills that the customers would send in with their personal ads. So at the end of the month, you go and they get a stack of ones and twos and you put on your gloves and accept payment. But if you got a check, you knew you had to go right to the bank.
Right. Yeah. That's what a Donnie Quirley was like in the beginning days.
Anyway, I was going to say that during those 6 months, I had this nice place over in Howland Avenue with a little private balcony. So every day I'd sit up there in the sun and just doodle.
Yeah.
And see what happened. That's how refunding was created, out of a single drawing, then expanded into a full page. And so refunding and Laszlo both were born here in Toronto. They're natives in a way. And I've got a strong connection to Toronto. I lived on Collier Street 35 years ago when I decided to make that, you know, break into comics. And it's kind of nice to come back 35 years later in somewhat better circumstances, because I was really nobody then.
I got a question for you. Were you a hippie?
Never.
No.
I love in Ontario.
That's great. I hate hippies.
Yeah. Well, I remember well. I recall the summer of love quite well. But suddenly, all these straight kids in my high school class were showing up with beads and bandanas, and I said, "You're not a hippie. You just saw the pictures of Life magazine."
Yeah.
Well, so
that's
I was always
on catch. I saw some pictures. But,
yeah, I was always highly suspicious of anything like that.
That's sad. But as much as I hate to end on that note, I'm getting away from Brad.
Right.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I would, again, just like thank you for coming.
Well, thank
and
you, Seth.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
It's a great Chester, honor.
Chester's going to come up. He's got a little few words to say here.
Yes, I'm Chester Brand. My name is mentioned a few times earlier in the evening.
I was taking a photograph of the hair.
That's right, there I am in my hippie days.
This was taken in Dallas in 1990 at the Harvey Awards. I was there, I got nominated, I didn't win in the humor category. And that was the Hernandez brothers in Chester and Dan Close, who did Ghost World in the middle. And on the left was my wife, Kathy. She's not here tonight. She's in San Francisco with my daughters, but yeah, she is.
Not here.
So that's 21 years ago, and I don't think any of us have changed a bit, except for Chester's hair. There's a
little less hair. Now.
I don't know if
that's going to
get that way. Anyway, there we are. That's a self-timer portrait.
I'm not bald. I get my hair
cut
this way.
I think that we've got another one. Solid pulp.
So anyway, I have the honor of delivering the official induction speech. Some of it's a bit redundant now, but I'm going to deliver it as written. Okay. Foul-tempered, quick to curse, as likely to urinate on a customer's plants as to deliver the milk they requested, and always eager to abandon his appointed rounds for a quick pit stop at a local bar, Reed Fleming more than lives up to his reputation as the world's toughest milkman. Indeed, Fleming can be easily called one of the funniest comic book characters ever created. Although he made his first appearance in 1980, Fleming is an almost miraculous throwback to the outlandish slapstick humor of early 20th century film and comic strips.
With his plebeian charm and outlaw antics, he's a fitting companion to W.C. Fields, Chaplin's Little Tramp, Barney Google, and the original two-fisted Popeye. Of course, Fleming wouldn't exist at all if it wasn't for the mind of David Boswell, a brilliant cartoonist and artistic jack of all trades, who we are honoring here tonight. Boswell was born in London, Ontario in 1953, where he grew up on a steady diet of old movies that were a staple of cable television at the time.
We didn't have cable.
Yeah. It's,
so our rotor, my dad would press a button and
same device. These movies, especially the screwball comedies of the 1930s, were a formative influence on his overall sensibility. So much so that Boswell would later study film at Oakville Sheridan College, where he graduated from in 1974. Not long after, the young Boswell was attracted to comics by tales of big money made by New Yorker cartoonists. Although he never made it into the venerable weekly, Boswell was successful at selling cartoons to the legendary BC counterculture magazine, The George Strait. Reed Fleming was originally created as a one-off character for a George Strait strip in 1978, but, like many legendary characters before him, Fleming took on a life of his own. Boswell continued chronicling Fleming's adventures in a self-published comic book, which was soon made into a series by Eclipse Comics in the U.S. Reed Fleming Comics enjoyed strong sales in the 1980s, going through multiple printings. The character was also optioned for a Hollywood film, with Boswell writing the script. Many comedians, including Jim Belushi, Jack Nicholson, Dave Thomas, Bob Hoskins, Jim Carrey, and Billy Bob Thornton, coveted the chance to bring Fleming to the big screen. But Reed proved more than vivid enough on the printed page. His uproarious adventures were brought to sharp reality by Boswell's labor-intensive cross-hatching style, wonderfully evocative of early 20th century illustrations. Among Boswell's chief achievements was the 1984 graphic novel Heartbreak Comics, featuring Laszlo, the great Slavic lover, which infused a surprisingly melancholy tone and adult sexuality to Fleming's hitherto boisterous universe. Much more could be said about Boswell, a multi-skilled artist who has also written screenplays and distinguished himself as a photographer. But for tonight, all that needs to be said is that Reed Fleming and Heartbreak Comics remain high watermarks of Canada's comics history, and more than earned David Boswell a place among the giants of the North.
Thank you.
some shuffling. Now, we're coming to the big finale, which is the Doug Gray Award for Best Book. And, without further delay, they are Bigfoot by Pascal Chagard, published by Drawn Quarterly. Bigfoot, small-town Quebec teenager and viral video victim, Jimmy slams full speed into the shaggy monster of adulthood as he is faced with first loves and broken friendships. A coming-of-age story that features a possible guest spot by a Sasquatch. Gerard's sure-footed pacing and dialogue combined with wispy line work and muted colors in a sublime cartooning tour de force. Bigfoot. Gerard was nominated for Best Emerging Talent Award in 2010, by the way, for his book Nicholas. Chimo by David Collier. Master of providing deep personal reflection with quirky forays into Canadian history, David Collier marked his return to comics with Chimo, a meaty and thought-provoking memoir of his service in the Canadian Forces Artists Program. Drawn with Collier's trademark cross-hatched authenticity, Chimo mines the Hamilton cartoonist experiences as a middle-aged man who re-enters the Canadian Army and comes out the other end with a renewed sense of mission as an artist. David Collier was previously nominated for Best Book Award in 2005 for his graphic novel, The Frank Ritza Papers. Chimo. Lose, number 2, by Michael DeForge, published by Cleano Press. The sophomore issue of Michael DeForge's personal anthology comic book series Lose takes an unexpected turn into modern horror. And a suburban Lord of the Flies for the post-9/11 set, DeForge exposes the inky black heart of his comic worldview to the squirm-inducing, hilarious story of a boy and his acid-spewing, dead horse-inhabiting alien spider. Oh, I didn't know they were aliens, actually, but that's good to know. DeForge won the Best Emerging Talent Award in 2010 for issue number 1 of Lose. Moving Pictures by Catherine Immonen and Stuart Immonen, published by Top Shelf. Husband and wife Catherine and Stuart Immonen give us a World War II tale that is focused on the value of art in a world defined by death. Moving Pictures is about a Canadian woman working as a curator in Nazi-occupied France who risks her life to save not people, but works of art. The book asks readers to consider whether art is valuable only when it's on the wall, and can that value help anyone? Moving Pictures. And finally, Streakers. Streakers by Nick Mandang. Streakers is the tale of Doug, Tim, and Xavier, three young creeps. Well, creeps is a bit extreme, I think. But anyway, three young creeps who make up the Streakers Association of Summit City, a club devoted to the appreciation and advancement of the art of streaking. Wittily and keenly observed, Mandag takes what could have been a hilarious one-joke premise and delivers a story of unexpected and rewarding depth. Streakers is one of the funniest and finest books of the year. Mandig was nominated for the Best Emerging Talent Award in 2008 for his book, The Experiment. And now, Book Streakers. There's another one. I'm very honored to open the envelope for the Best Book winner. And that winner is Bigfoot. Bigfoot.
Hello everyone, and congratulations to Pascal Girard. Vous comprenez l'anglais? Oui. No? Oui? Espagnol? Okay. I just very quickly, the jury I was on was the jury for the Emerging Artist Award as well as the Book of the Year Award. And I just want to say, you know, two winners get announced, and it can be a letdown for the others. And I just want to tell you that as jurors, we loved all of these books, and we were thrilled to have them in front of us and have the opportunity to read them. As a novelist myself, I don't get asked to sit on juries where books are less than 400 pages long. So it's a delight to have to be handed 10 comic books and be asked to read them. I want to say about the winning book that Jar's Bigfoot is a book that uses all of the unique aspects available to an artist working in this medium. First off, it is a great story, and it's beautifully told and wonderfully written. The characters are absolutely specific and recognizable, and they speak in their own voices. And the story crests and ebbs with fantastic and wonderful tension throughout the whole book, which is also written, despite the fact that it is also a novel, it is written with wonderful economy. But then there's also the cartooning itself, which is very apt for the story, and once you've seen the pictures, it's impossible to imagine the story being told without these images. This is a story of late childhood, and the people in this story look like they're about 6 or 7 years older than Charlie Brown. They're not adults yet, they're kids gone to seed. And the colors that Pascal brings to the page are the colors of late childhood. The tints and shades are coming in, but everything is still relatively bright and hopeful. The marriage of storytelling style and drawing style is absolutely perfect in this book. And each layer deepens the other. Everyone in the jury absolutely loved it. So I'm very honored to be part of a jury that plays a role in awarding this wonderful book and this terrific artist. Congratulations.
Thank you. First, I want to thank Elise Boudreau, who did the color with me on the book and really helped me on the color because I didn't use Photoshop so much before. I want to try and thank everyone at John and Quality, Chris, Peggy, Tom, Jessica, Julia, everyone, because they're very great publisher and the best publisher to translate my work because I don't write in English. And I want to thanks to the French publisher of the book, Pastèque, who Frédéric and Martin, who first believe in the book. And I would like to thanks to Jimmy Beaulieu and the audience, who was my first publisher, and I started drawing comic because I read his comic. So thank you, and yeah, thank you, Chris, thank you, everyone. And I don't have, wow, I'm surprised, that's great. I don't have a long speech, but I know I'm Tom said I can use my charming French accent, so everyone's always charmed by that. But it's really a great honor, and thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. Congratulations, Pascal, and to all the... It was a great bunch of books. Great year for Canadian Commons. Bob, would you like to show what you've done tonight? What have you done? I've been watching you from the front of my...
Where were you last time?
About at some point. Oh. And you did that without even looking, I noticed. That was very impressive. It's free. Wow. Jeez. That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you very much. We're definitely going to be auctioned off at the party. Is that the idea? We'll see. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Greg and the panel. Thank you, everyone. I'm sure Brad's going to give a long wrap up. But for me. From me, thank you so much for giving me the honor once again to host. See you at the party. Thank you very much.
You only heard the ones you love.
race out for another thing, but I want to thank her. I also wanted to point out that John Marks was the evil genius behind that awesome Jack Layton gag, the happy ending, which is fantastic. And I want to thank Bob Sequoia for doing this for us, which is great. Maybe you can break down and continue it at the party or something. Increasingly more intoxicated. Yeah, and I also want to, again, thank Greg Morrison. Tony Award winning. Are we doing some books?
Yeah, there'll be books outside.
There's books outside to sign. If anyone wants to buy them, of the winners. Thanks for coming, and thank you for all the nominees for coming. That's it.